morning. Today we have five cases scheduled for oral argument. We are beginning with the Krelitz matter. I'd like both attorneys, before you begin, to please pronounce your names and that of your party, and also let us know how you'd like us to refer to you and your client during the arguments this morning. Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Samuel Johnson, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Michael Krelitz. And you may refer to me as Sam, or Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Krelitz as either husband or appellant in this matter.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Sam Johnson, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Michael Krelitz, in this matter. Your Honors, we're here today to address four categories of issues contained in the court's judgment and decree following a contested trial in 2020. Those four categories are the division of assets and debts in the marriage, the incorrect calculation of spousal maintenance, leading to an award of $83.96 to Ms. Leonard in this matter. The inappropriate and wrongful assignment of liability for unpaid income taxes in 2017 to Mr. Krelitz, and the denial of Mr. Krelitz's conduct-based attorney's fees motion. For each of these reasons, Your Honors, we respectfully request that you reverse the decision of the district court and remand for further proceedings. Turning to the first category before the court today, that is the debts and assets of the parties, there are five errors that the district court made before you today. The first is the U.S. Bank Visa debt of $25,500 that undeniably existed as of the valuation date, undeniably was a marital debt, and was undeniably paid off by Mr. Krelitz after the valuation date. And the district court abused its discretion in failing to include this debt on the balance sheet to the prejudice of Mr. Krelitz.
Mr. Johnson, when you say failed to include, are you aware of any findings at all that the district court made regarding this debt?
No, Your Honor, there are absolutely no findings as to this debt, which is an abuse of discretion for two reasons. First, it is clear from the record that it should have been included on the balance sheet, and its exclusion from the balance sheet led to an erroneous calculation of an equalizer payment. But beyond that, if the court had intended to exclude it, as the respondent argues, the court was required to make particularized findings as to that reason, whether it was equitable or some other reason justified exclusion from the balance sheet. So on that issue, Your Honor, clear error is apparent in the record. The party's tax debt is also, for the exact same reason, an error which must be reversed. As of the time—
That's the Minnesota tax debt.
Yes, Your Honor. It was just shy of $13,000 as of the valuation date. It was owed to the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And it existed as of the valuation date. It was undeniably a marital asset, and it was undeniably paid off by Mr. Krelitz after the valuation date. The court omitted that debt from the balance sheet as well. And despite—
Johnson, can I clarify? When you say the court needs to make, following up to your last, and it might apply to this one too, whenever is it appropriate for a district court to not include it at all, as opposed to considering whether it's marital versus non-marital debt, which maybe there's a separate category, if you follow my question, it seems that all debts of the parties, whether marital or non-marital, need to be considered and somewhere included in an order.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's the central argument, is that a debt that existed as of the valuation date or an asset that existed as of the valuation date must be considered by the court in dividing up the marital estate. Now, if the court wanted to apportion a different amount of debt to Mr. Krelitz than to Ms. Leonard, the court was within its discretion to do so, but it did not do that here. It simply excluded the balance from
the— Mr. Johnson, you'd agree that there are times when one party believes that an item belongs as part of the marital estate, the other party disagrees, the court has to decide whether to include that or not include that. That is the main dispute. Let's say there's no issue on the value of it. You would agree that there are times, and the statute doesn't say the district court has to make findings if it decides to exclude an asset, right? And there are times when our court might look at that and try to determine if there are any implicit findings to support that decision.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, and I would say that the court is required to address all debts and assets under the statute that exist as of the valuation date. Again, it can set a different valuation date if it wants. It can apportion the debts and liabilities or the assets in a way that is equitable as opposed to equal, but it must at least address the debt that existed and which is undisputed in the record as to existing.
Does the statute require a district court to set forth findings as to why, let's say, a debt, for example, I'm sure you're going to get to it soon, as to why the loan from husband's mother was not an asset or debt or liability to be included? Does the statute require consideration of that and some findings as to support the decision not to include something?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it does, because part of the Henry case talks about particularized findings. One of the things that is necessary for the district court to do is state the reasons for its decision, both so that the parties can understand why something happened and so we may have effective appellate review. In this case, this court and the parties have no idea why this was excluded. It just wasn't mentioned at all. But the record—
Meaning, now again, not the loan, but correct, the tax and the Visa debt.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Those two debts are the only ones which were purposefully excluded from the balance sheet, or at least maybe accidentally, but the court was given the opportunity to correct that error and did not.
And I think the gist of your argument is we can't really review if the district court properly exercised its discretion because we don't know if it even considered it.
Yes, Your Honor. And the failure to make particularized findings persists throughout the judgment and decree, as we note repeatedly in our briefing to Your Honors. There are failures to make particularized findings when it comes to the calculation of spousal maintenance and as to other assets. But I'll move to the other assets and debts that exist.
Can I ask you, Mr. Johnson, I'm going to jump back to that loan, the loan from husband's mother. I'm looking at finding 80. So we know there is a finding here, of course.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we defer to the judge in terms of ultimate decision and clear error for the finding. I want to ask you how to interpret two parts of this finding 80. The second sentence says it does appear that Annette Krelitz provided approximately $90,000 to $100,000 to the parties. But then towards the bottom, given all the unknowns to this equation, the court finds that while Annette Krelitz provided funds to help him out when he was having difficulty making ends meet, he has not demonstrated that these funds were, quote, and this is in the finding, quote, unquote, loaned to him or on what terms. How do we read those two sentences? The first one suggested to me the court found it was a loan for the parties. But that sentence suggests that it may or may not have been a loan, for one thing, and if it was a loan, it may have been to your client.
Your Honor, I would answer that in two ways. First, saying that the court's findings are somewhat contradictory there. On one hand, you're right. The court does identify it as a loan that was provided, or money that was provided to the parties during the marriage. But the court then goes on to conclude that it may not be a loan. I think that's what the court ultimately concluded. And it did so using contract analysis, saying there wasn't, at least suggesting there wasn't some meeting of the minds, and that it wasn't distilled down into a written agreement. And that's really the crux of the court's refusal to consider that loan, the lack of a written agreement. And that's throughout the finding. But that's not dispositive of whether a loan, particularly to the parties in a family case, is a loan. And there's a number of cases.
There was also, I don't disagree with that, but there was also, you know, the evidence was conflicting. I mean, the your client and his mother had different understandings about how much and how much was owing and how much had been paid. And what didn't that factor into the district court's decision that your client hadn't met his burden of showing that this was, in fact, a loan and part of the marital debt?
Well, Your Honor, there was initially a conflict between the amount owed. Mr. Krelitz at first testified that I believe $95,000 was owed, but later clarified that in sync with what Ms. Krelitz said, that $90,000 was owed. So the parties agree, I'm sorry, Ms. Krelitz and Ms. Annette Krelitz and Mr. Krelitz, my client, agree that $90,000 was owed as of the valuation date. And the testimony is unrebutted on that point. Ms. Leonard didn't offer any testimony. There's no other evidence in the record other than money was provided, which is undisputed. The money went to pay the marital standard of living and to pay down tax debt. There were routine and frequent repayments on that loan to Ms. Krelitz throughout the life of the marriage from an account that Ms. Krelitz, Ms. Leonard, was aware of and had access to. So none of that is rebutted in the record.
I don't want to overlook a piece of this that to me is maybe something we start with. it is clear, because it's more common, that any party who is seeking to exclude an asset from the marital estate, there's a presumption that if it was acquired during the marriage, it's marital. And so that party would have some burden, additional burden, to prove that it's not marital.
Correct, Your
Honor. Given the presumption. Are you making that same argument here? Because there is some language, as Judge Sleeter just quoted, that it may appear the district court required your client to carry a burden. Are you making any argument that that was a misapplication of law and that, in fact, it's the other party who has a burden because the purported loan was acquired during the marriage?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that point, and that's Minnesota Statute 518.003 as to the definition of marital property and non-marital property. The court did, in effect, shift the burden of proving that this was a marital asset to Mr. Krelitz, which, when it was undeniably loaned to the parties during the marriage. What should have happened is Ms. Leonard should have borne the legal burden of proving that it was not a marital debt, and she did not. She offered no testimony to rebut it. Your Honor, I want to move to the issue of spousal maintenance.
Before you move on, I didn't see that argument in your brief, so I wasn't sure that the shifting burden argument, that as an error of law, I saw the argument that the evidence itself was sufficient in your mind to make it an error of fact to exclude the loan, but I didn't see one about shifting the burden, which is why I asked the question.
I appreciate the clarification, Your Honor. I don't believe that issue was briefed, but obviously the burdens proof do apply, and I would make the argument now that Ms. Krelitz or Ms. Leonard did not meet her burden of proof, and the district court inappropriately shifted the burden of proof. Turning now to spousal maintenance, there were four categories of error that the court committed in calculating the spousal maintenance award to Ms. Leonard. The easiest and quickest to resolve is actually the retroactivity argument. The court made the spousal maintenance award retroactive to the date of trial. And that violates Minnesota Statute 518A.39, and as this court has interpreted the Raworth case, under which spousal maintenance may only be made retroactive to when a party has notice and opportunity to respond, because to do otherwise violates notions of due process and fair play. Here, there was never a motion by Ms. Krelitz to establish retroactive spousal maintenance. The petition itself never seeks retroactive spousal maintenance, and the only time retroactive spousal maintenance is sought by Ms. Krelitz is in the November post-trial proposed findings and judgment and decree, to which Mr. Krelitz had no opportunity to respond. The retroactive...
Does it change if we consider the fact that this really wasn't... I mean, there was a temporary maintenance order, but this is the first time spousal maintenance had been decided based on all the evidence. So in some ways, it isn't like you're facing a motion to modify, which is the classic situation where the retroactivity goes to the date of the motion. So does your argument about retroactivity appropriately consider the fact that this was, in fact, the first time spousal maintenance has been decided?
No, Your Honor. I believe the Raworth case is directly on point with this, which says that it looks to whether the petition asked for retroactive spousal maintenance or prospective spousal maintenance. And in that case, the court awarded spousal maintenance as of the first of the month following the entry of the J&D, and then in a motion for amended findings, retroactively made it back to the start of the case.
And what was the starting date for the permanent, not pendente lite, temporary spousal maintenance? And again, we're not talking about the kind of spousal maintenance that's rehabilitative and temporary in that sense. We're talking about while the case is pending, there was a spousal maintenance, a temporary award. And in this case, the permanent award was to begin on what date?
As of the date of trial, Your Honor,
and that's different
1st.
From, is it Raworth?
It is Raworth, yes, Your
Honor.
Yeah,
it seems to me pretty different then.
That fact can distinguish it, but this court was clear that notice is required, and that's what Minnesota Statute 518A.39 requires. That's the reason you require notice, is because a party is aware that retroactive spousal maintenance is to be litigated. We didn't litigate the issue of retroactivity at the trial. We didn't litigate the issue of retroactivity in the post-trial filings. It was never clear to us that retroactive spousal maintenance would be sought. And the effect of the retroactive spousal maintenance is that Mr. Krelitz was assigned $42,000 in retroactive spousal maintenance. Again, assuming the original award of spousal maintenance was upheld, he's responsible for $42,000 in spousal maintenance he wasn't aware or budgeted for as a matter of law. So I would respectfully request that you reverse that decision and at the earliest make spousal maintenance effective as of March 1st. Now, the remainder of the calculation was also erroneous for a number of reasons. First, the court overstated the marital standard of living by not including deficit spending in its calculation. This party spent a substantial amount beyond their means, sometimes $5,000 to $7,000 more per month than the marital standard of living as captured by the court in its findings of fact. You have to, under the Chamberlain and Pollock case, back that deficit spending out. So finding that the marital standard of living was $20,400 per month was wrong because the parties couldn't afford to spend that amount. So that has to be taken out. You also have to take out double-dipping expenses incurred in Ms. Krelitz's budget and as write-offs to her tax income. And there are a host of other issues, as we just detail in our brief, for which the spousal maintenance calculation was erroneous. But I see that my time has expired, Your Honor, so unless you have any questions.
Thank you. And you will have some time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Haugen. You may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Haugen, and I'm here on behalf of respondent Linda Beth Leonard this morning. Your Honors, an overarching theme in this case is that appellant seeks to overturn a myriad of decisions by asking this court to relitigate maintenance and property decisions rightly made and decided by the trial court. And not only were those rightly made and decided, but they were rooted in the history of this case, the history of the parties, they were rooted in principles of equity required of the trial court, and the abilities, particularly on spousal maintenance, of the parties going forward based on the history of their marriage, the history of their careers, and what the court could reasonably expect. They were also based on a lengthy proceeding, voluminous discovery, and a deep record, which I know this court reviews in detail prior to these proceedings. I do want to start with three issues that counsel addressed in appellant's argument.
Before you do that, Mr. Haugen, you use the phrase that the court rightly decided. How do we square non-decided loans that aren't in there? They haven't been decided. How do we review that other than send it back to have the court deal with them before they can be reviewed? Do you follow my question?
I do, and I'm going to take off my glasses and set them down because I realized when I looked up you were a little fuzzy, the readers, so I'm just going to leave them off.
I often look real fuzzy anyway, but if it's better, that's good.
Right. The issue on that is that, Your Honor, is Minnesota Statute 518.58 discusses that the district court may adjust the valuation of any asset or debt during the pendency of trial. And in this case, the retirement of marital debt with admittedly, husband's income was made during the pendency of the proceeding. So the court elected, by my reading of the record, to simply consider that debt retired, which was acknowledged at trial that it was now retired, and leave it off the balance sheet. I don't know of anything that counsel briefed or that I'm aware of that requires the court to make a specific finding that it was retired, particularly when the parties acknowledged that the U.S. bank debt and the tax debt of roughly $12,000 were retired during the 2 days of trial.
But wouldn't, if one party paid down a marital debt during the pendency of the case, wouldn't that potentially affect the overall value of the estate and therefore the equalizer payment?
Your Honor, it can, but it doesn't have to. I think the answer to your question is cut two different ways. So certainly it can if the court finds that it should be appropriately considered as paid down for some reason during the trial.
But again, if one party pays the marital debt during the trial, it seems like that's the kind of thing that has to be included in the balance sheet.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree, because the retirement of the debt no longer exists on a marital balance sheet at
the time of
trial.
What if you sold a house during the pendency, and one party sold the house, and one party received proceeds? That debt shouldn't be reflected?
That's a different question, with respect, Your Honor, because the mortgage debt actually is no longer listed at a final trial decision if the house was sold and that debt was satisfied in the pendency of the proceeding. So while the district court would deal with potentially the proceeds of that sale as divided, it would not deal with the retirement of the mortgage itself, because that debt is done and gone. And particularly in this case, when the court reviews the entirety of the record, the motion for temporary relief, which I know we'll get to particularly on spousal maintenance, the court was very clear that the party should not rely on its award of spousal maintenance of roughly $1,700 as a final, as an indication of what it would do at trial. But as part of that proceeding, husband also represented that he would continue to pay certain debts of the parties, and that was within his budget during the pendency of the proceeding. That was part of what husband used to buttress the fact that he should pay a lower temporary spousal maintenance award. So at trial, I would submit to the court that while the court re-examined spousal maintenance, it also rightly chose to disregard debts that had been retired with marital income during the proceeding, because they simply no longer existed, and the court felt it shouldn't be included in an equalizer based on what we have in the record. I do want to say that if
the court simply overlooked it. I mean, there were a lot of issues and a lot of evidence presented during this two-day trial. It seems to me, given error that you agree, for example, the district court's findings with respect to Ms. Leonard's monthly and annual income or earning capacity, as it were, and other things. I mean, at some point, doesn't it make it hard for this court to really review the findings and determine whether this was overall an equitable split without better findings?
Your Honor, admittedly, it may. But that would lead to a different result, respectfully, than what appellant is seeking. Appellant is asking this court for a reversal on these issues. There may be narrow issues that this court looks at and says a finding is not sufficient, and we want to remand to the court to sufficiently include a finding as to that issue. And there may be issues like, as we state in our brief, Ms. Leonard's income of whether it's $50,000 or $5,000 a month, which would then be $60,000 annually. But that would be a remand on a narrow issue for clarification, as would be the U.S. bank debt. There
and
weren't
the
sufficient
state income tax
or
debt.
Or the income tax debt. There isn't a sufficient finding for this court to determine that the court chose to disregard that debt for a specific reason, therefore remand for further findings and additional decision. That is a different result than a reversal, and we do address that in our brief, that remanding on narrow issues may be appropriate, considering the issues in this case. We can't avoid that.
If it's a narrow issue that affects the equalizer, isn't that the starting point for spousal maintenance?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
Isn't the starting point for spousal maintenance the property division, and then you decide if based on that division there's a need for maintenance? So if we were to remand for further findings on a narrow issue in the property division, where does that leave us on spousal maintenance?
I don't think it leaves us anywhere different than where we are, Your Honor, which is that spousal maintenance was rightly decided, and this is the reason for that. First of all, whether parties have sufficient assets or debt assets to meet their needs is part of the statutory analysis. Our position is that the retirement of a $25,000 U.S. bank debt and a $12,000 income tax debt would be $37,000 on a balance sheet of debt that would be assigned to Mr. Kralitz. That would actually decrease any property that Ms. Leonard would receive if Mr. Kralitz received credit for those. So it is impossible in my mind for the court to come to a conclusion that by decreasing the asset and debt equalizer owed to Ms. Leonard, somehow it would upset the court's spousal maintenance analysis on her having sufficient property to meet her needs.
I mean, I guess it's possible if we remanded for further findings that there would then be a basis for you to argue for more maintenance.
We're not seeking that. I suppose we could, but our position is that after a year and a half of litigation and 2 days of trial, the court rightly decided spousal maintenance. And if I could turn there, I think that's for several points. One is that appellant focuses quite a bit on the idea of deficit spending. And we fully acknowledge that the parties live beyond their means. That was a theme at trial. And that is not an uncommon theme that the lower court has to deal with at times. But what the lower court did here is it took the analysis of financial experts from both parties that analyzed cash in and cash out and said, this is how much cash in we can expect based on the history of your marriage, based on a 5-year average income for Mr. Kralitz that takes into account up years and down years, not just the 3 lighter years that he wanted the court to use, and says, this is how much cash the court can reasonably expect these parties to have. And because you have both lived with on your, beyond your means, the court can only allocate the cash before it. And in doing so, and that's what the court did here. So spousal maintenance was appropriately decided because assets and debts don't change, in our position, the underlying analysis that the court engaged in on spousal maintenance and the challenges the court had to face, which was spending beyond their means, an average income that will go up and down, a wife re-entering the career after over a decade out of the workforce, rebuilding a career in her 50s with limited time to build that business, to save for retirement, and to do things that, while the parties didn't do much of it during their marriage, they did it in husband's name and in his accounts, not in wife's, as you saw.
Mr. Haugen, would you then characterize, in a broad sense, the district court's findings as retro, in terms of standard of living, and as you said, the current money in and money out, would you characterize it, or yes, he does, to characterize those findings as essentially eliminating the beyond their means standard of living down to what their standard of living within their means was, if you follow my, when extrapolating current budget and expenses?
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think the court deals with that directly within its findings. In fact, when it discusses that it is not the court's job to tell the parties how to spend their money. It is the court's role to determine what money was available and how they spent it during the marriage.
The reason I was asking, too, at one point I thought I saw a finding where the judge did say, but that is how they lived. And so I wasn't sure if that meant, so I'm going to use that, but you are describing it in a big picture that no, that the judge actually did bring it down to a within their means standard of living when calculating spousal maintenance.
That's correct, Your Honor. So findings, I believe it's 43 through 60, are the court's broad spousal maintenance analysis on every point. And it's roughly finding, I think it's roughly finding 50, and I don't want to spend too much time in my notes, that's why I'm saying roughly, that the court directly says both parties acknowledge they live beyond their means. They can't continue to live beyond their means. We're not going to reward one party, here husband, by decreasing wife's spousal maintenance based on them living beyond their means. What we are going to do is divide cash flow that we can see they have, and they're going to have to figure out how to live within that cash flow from there, because the court can't direct them, aside from allocating the cash flow, the court can't direct them how to spend that cash. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Okay.
I want to touch on the retroactivity piece briefly in my final few minutes.
Mr. Haugen, though, I did have another question. I wanted to go back to a debt to get your response to finding 80 in terms of husband's
certainly
the loan. Overall, as I read that, it seems like it mostly, except for that last sentence, it was a little unsure with the quote around whether it was loaned to him or what terms, that indeed it's, and as he pointed out, it seems unrebutted that there was a loan for the parties, but the judge seemed focused solely on undocumented. I assume you would agree as a matter of law, you don't need documentation if there's a loan. There has to be a determination, of course, on whether marital or non-marital. So how would you ask us to review that finding as it relates to this loan and why it's excluded from the balance sheet?
Your Honor, I would ask you to review that finding in the context of finding 79, which immediately precedes it, which deals with the marital loan that wife received from her mother. And the court went through, there was questioning at trial, and the court in its findings directly distinguishes these two loans. The issue with money received from family in family law cases is whether they are gifts or loans. So they take a different degree of analysis than simply a debt front that you can produce from a credit card company, say. And what the court said is wife's loan was documented. There was a note prepared by her parents' family attorney to secure this. There was an expectation to pay back. There were terms included, etc. And conversely, what was not present in husband's funds received from his mother, it wasn't just about documentation. It was that neither party who appeared for testimony could provide what the true balance was owed, the interest rate being applied, what payments had been made, what payments were expected to be made, on what schedule, when it was expected to be paid off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't just about documentation. It was about everything that comes to documentation that neither Mr. Krelitz or his mother could speak to in adequate detail for the court when they testified at trial. And I would also note that all of those records, if they existed and could provide those, were in the possession of either Ms. Krelitz, his mother, or Mr. Krelitz, appellant, and those records were not produced in sufficient detail like Ms. Leonard's records were regarding her loan. So you need to read them collectively and not just as a standalone finding. And I see my time is up, so I'll yield.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor's on rebuttal. I think it's important to look first to Ms. Leonard's brief on this matter, which tells you more about how you should decide this matter based on what's not there versus what is there. Wife avoids a number of arguments that are not helpful to her, specifically dealing with the U.S. bank debt, the Minnesota Department of Revenue tax debt that we discussed earlier, the tax liability of $35,000 on wife's unreported income, this being the court found Mr. Krelitz responsible and liable for the unreported income in 2017 when it was in reality Ms. Leonard's tax or income that was unreported and which caused the problem. But it was wrongful to then assign Mr. Krelitz responsibility for the fees, the interest, the payments, the penalties. Wife doesn't discuss the business expenses. This is a significant issue that affects her budget. Wife not expensed her car, portions of her home, her cell phone, and her utilities to the business, thereby driving down her income, because this is her wholly owned business. But then the court allowed those amounts to also be included on her budget. That's a double dip. It's a clear and erroneous double dip, Your Honors, to allow her to decrease her income for the purposes of calculating spousal maintenance and to award her spousal maintenance on a budget, which includes those expensed items.
Counsel, Mr. Haugen made the point in his argument that that really, to the extent there are these issues, the relief that you're seeking on behalf of your client of reversal is not appropriate, and that what would be appropriate potentially is a remand for further findings by the district court. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor. I believe...
What issues are subject to reversal, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I believe that Your Honors should reverse the equalization of the party's marital assets, not just for further findings, but for reverse the award of the equalizer payment, remand if necessary for further findings, but certainly reverse that. Reverse the award of spousal maintenance. It is simply too high. Mr. Krelitz cannot afford what was ordered by the court. It's forcing him into a cycle of feast and famine where he can't make payments because it was based on income that he doesn't have and doesn't earn. It was based off a marital standard that was calculated solely on spending, not on the deficit, because that's what the court did here. The court said the
marital... This court can pick a number and reverse and direct the district court, or should reverse and say no spousal maintenance is owed?
I believe the court should reverse the judgment and then remand for the court to make have additional proceedings, make further findings. I don't believe this court should sit and pick the spousal maintenance number. I don't think that that is properly before you today. I think what the district court should, armed with this court's guidance on what is appropriate and what is not appropriate, what is required under the cases of Chamberlain, Madden, Paula, Raworth, all of these cases inform how spousal maintenance is to be calculated and how the district court erred. Back to the piece of spousal maintenance and the marital standard of living. The marital standard was calculated to be $20,400 per month based on the spending. But the parties spent $5,000 to $7,000 a month in deficit spending, if you examine Exhibits 11A and 11B. That right there reduces the marital standard to between $15,000 and $13,000. Again, a substantial departure from the district court. The district court also included an outlier year, 2015, where the spending was double any of the other years. That's not appropriately the marital standard. That's excessive and includes one-time expenses like travel to Israel for a bar mitzvah, children's expenses, travel expenses. Even Ms. Leonard's own expert agreed that that was not the proper standard to include that year, only relenting upon pressure from Ms. Leonard. So reducing that to $15,000 and $13,000 and then backing out the budgeted expenses that Ms. Leonard double-dipped, you really have a standard of living that's somewhere between $10,000 and $12,000, which is less than the court found Ms. Krelitz's budget to begin with, finding that her budget was $11,537 plus backing out of her income insurance. So in reality, her budget is more than the entire marital standard of living as found by the district court. That's clear error against the facts on the record and should be reversed. To answer Your Honor's question about the documentation of the loan, the sole reason the district court made a distinction between Ms. Leonard's loan and Mr. Krelitz's loan or Ms. Krelitz's loan, is the documentation. All the other boxes that the court looked at and checked were checked in both cases. The only difference is the documentation that was not present for the loan from Annetta Krelitz. Everything else tells this court and should have told the district court that it was a loan, it should have been included on the balance sheet, and it was error to not do so. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we would respectfully request that you reverse remand for further proceedings, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We will issue an order within the statutory time frame. The matter has now been submitted to this court.